Welcome to SciShow Tangents. It's the Layla competitive knowledge showcase starring some of the geniuses that make the YouTube series SciShow happen. This week, as always, I'm joined by Stefan Chin.
Good evening.
What's your tagline, Stefan?
Wheelbarrow for my dreams.
Sam Schultz is also here. Sam, what's your tagline?
Big Bad Beetleborg.
Sari Riley is here as well. Hello, Sari.
Hello.
What's your tagline?
A whole lot of blubber.
Well, that might make more sense in a moment, unless you've already read the title of the podcast. And I'm Hank Green, and my tagline is the memory of the time that you found that bag.
Which...
What? Every week here on SciShow Tangents, we try to get together to one of amaze and delight each other with science facts. We're playing for glory, but we're also keeping score and awarding Sam Bucks from week to week. We do everything we can to stay on topic, but we're not always great at that. So if the rest of the team deems your tangent unworthy, we will force you to give up one of your Sam Bucks. So tangent with care, and I really can't afford it, so I'm going to be careful. And as always, we're going to introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem this week from Stefan.
This poem is called Character Selection. If your spirit has always wanted to set sail, you could do much worse than being spawned as a whale. Those beasts beautifully breaching the surface to inhale, though they were almost hunted to extinction. That's an important detail. But you could strain the sea through a comb-like baleen. That's the biggest krill cocktail that's ever been seen. Or if you'd rather be a toothed whale in this scene, you could be the narwhal. It's just a unicorn that's marine. You could be a humpback singing in the dead of night, a blue whale that's bigger than anything, dead or alive, a Cuvier's beaked if you'd prefer the deepest dives, or a bowhead whale. They live the longest lives. And after you've lived that long life roaming free, you'll ultimately head to the bottom of the sea, where for decades other creatures will enjoy quite the feast. And then you can choose a new life, maybe this time as a tree.
Oh, man. Got a little bit of spirituality in there, too.
I love the sensation of just grooving along with you on a really good rhyme scheme, and then you do a slant rhyme.
Well, you know, I had to throw one in there.
Mm-hmm. It was a very death-positive poem, too. I like it. Yeah. It's like, you're still part of it. Let things eat your flesh.
So the topic for today is whales. And as far as I know, this is a fairly distinct taxonomic distinction. There's definitely sort of the dolphins and whales. And then you're like definitely on your island. But then if you just say whales, is there some bleed over? Like, where does that line happen?
The line is somewhere at the order level. So dolphins, whales, and porpoises are all in the class Mammalia, which includes all other mammals. And then they're in the order, and I found two names for this, Artiodactyla or Cetartiodactyla, which is all the even-toed ungulates. So
deer and dolphins are the same.
Yeah, and hippos, they're all kind of in the same order. And then there are suborders, and I think they just ran out of taxonomic levels. And so they were like, oh, I guess all this has to happen at the order level. There's a suborder called Whippomorpha. Not exactly sure what is in that, but the important part is the infraorder Cetacea is where whales excludes dolphins and porpoises.
Okay.
Oh.
And the thing we call killer whales are not in that order. They are in the dolphins and porpoises group.
Mm-hmm. How are they figuring out how many toes a whale's got? Is it in their fins?
Yeah, it's in their fins. Like their fins are just adapted hooves, basically.
So they still got fingies in there. They're just finned up.
Anything with like a fin or a wing, I'm pretty sure. Most things with fins or wings also still have fingies if you look close enough.
Interesting.
Do you know where the etymology of the whale?
Yeah, it seems like it comes from Proto-Indo-European for qualo or squalo, which is the source of Latin squalus, which is a kind of large sea fish. So it seems like people were like, it's a big thing in the ocean and probably called a lot of things whales or variations thereof. Same thing with that order that I mentioned, Cetacea. It's from the Latin cetus or cetus, which is any large sea creature or like a sea monster, essentially.
Finally, yeah. some reasonable origins for these words. Come on.
I love that we're like, sea monsters don't exist. But like to people in the past, they're like, what do you mean? We see them all the time. Uh-huh. There's giant things that live in the sea and they like hit our boats. There's fish that we eat, all the stuff we can safely ignore, and then the things that we cannot ignore. And we have a word for that. Thank you, Sari. And now it is time for where I have brought some science facts, but only one of them is going to be true. You can play along at home at twitter.com/scishowtangents. We'll do our best to have that up before you tweet to us to let us know that we forgot.
I got a lot of irons in the fire, you know?
There's a lot going on, absolutely. The rest of you guys have to figure out which is the true fact. And also all of you at home have to figure that out. And if you get it right, you get the sandbuck. If you don't, then I get the sandbuck. Everybody, are you ready to hear what I've brought for you today?
Yes.
So we were just talking about killer whales and how they're not whales, but they're called whales, so here they are. And they poop, which is not a super surprise, but I was surprised to find that their poop does something weird. It floats for a little bit, and it is a bright orange, so fairly easy to see, snotty, this is how it was described to me, snotty mass. And then it sinks. So it is only on top of the surface for a little while before it starts to sink. And for almost everyone on Earth, this is not an issue. You will never find yourself thinking, boy, I wish that whale poop hadn't sunk, unless you are a scientist who studies whale health. Because if you are that scientist, you would like to collect that fecal matter and analyze it to learn vital things about the health of local whale populations. So scientists do very much want to collect whale poop. However, it sinks fairly quickly, so they had to develop a way to get the whale poop. Mm-hmm. And one of these ways is the way. The other two are made up. So here is number way one. Number one way. Scientists have trained dogs to sniff out the whale poop, taking the dog out on a boat. You don't just like throw the dog in the water, okay, to be clear. You take the dog out on the boat, and then the dog will smell the whale poop and then point the people in the right direction until they get to the place where the promising smell originated. Fact number two, scientists have designed a robot pooper scooper for the whales. The robot is operated remotely and it swims along with the whales. And then when a poop arrives, the pooper scooper knows that because it's already there with the whales. And then it can collect the poop and then make its way back to the scientists wherever they are at. Or fact number three, scientists created a temporary killer whale litter box. So how the heck do you do that? Well, you don't actually tell them to poop somewhere. You just make sure that they show up somewhere. So you lure the killer whales to a designated area by congregating a bunch of things that look like fishing boats. And whales like fishing boats because they often have a bunch of like fish being thrown off of them that are like bycatch. And then the whales get to eat that. So they're attracted to the sound and the shape of those fishing, like things that look like fishing boats. The whales move in and then they're, you know, just because they're like getting ready to eat, or maybe just because they're around, they poop. And that allows the scientists to see it because it's pretty visible in the water and grab it. So again, your facts, and if you want to play along at home, go to twitter.com/scishowtangents, are dogs trained to sniff out the poop, you've got a robot pooper scooper, and you've got a killer whale litter box made out of fishing boats.
Oh boy. So this is not an AI robot. This is a controlled robot? Like
it is a human operated robot, yes.
Okay. I don't know how you'd see the whales.
What? Just go out on just buy a ticket on one of those whale watching expeditions and take your little robot pooper scooper with you.
I don't think scientists have to buy tickets to whale watching expeditions.
Yeah, I think that they're studying whales that have fairly established routines. So they're local whales. Mm. So they have some idea of where the whale is going to be.
And that one solves the question of like scooping it up too, because the robot just does it. You don't have to put it in your boat with your dog. a big turd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the dog one feels like it has very strong pros and cons. Like, pro, the dog would be having a great time on the boat, probably, yeah, as long as it's, like, looking around, lots of things to sniff. Con, how do you even get the poop?
Yeah.
Like, reach out with one of those pool scoopers and pick it up. Also, with my one experience with a hound dog that sniffs, we had a beagle growing up, and she would just stick her face into anything that she wanted to smell, and especially if it was stinky, because she wanted to get as much of the smell as possible. Mm-hmm. It's possible that she wasn't very smart, but also, I don't know how she would, I think she would get very confused if wind was carrying a scent from far away and, like, pointing in different directions. Mm. Maybe there are hunting dogs that are better at, like, localizing a scent.
Ocean hunting dogs.
Yeah.
Poop hunting dogs.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the dogs.
I cannot emphasize how bright orange whale poop is or killer whale poop is. It's just like terrifyingly bright orange.
Are you going to tell us why it's so orange, or is it just,
I don't know the answer to that question. Yeah. I did look at a number of pictures of whale poop.
But, but you just said, wow, orange, and left it at that.
Yep. I had other things to figure out.
And then the litter box, that feels reasonable to me. Mm-hmm. Also, yeah. Get animals to poop in a place. It's a storied human tradition. As long as we've domesticated animals, it's like poop here. And animals also seem to tend to poop in set places.
Uh-huh. So wait, are they feeding them out of these fishing boats too?
They aren't. They don't have to. The whales anticipate that there will be food.
Okay, so they're getting ready to chow down. Mm-hmm. Cream meal pooping.
Definitely, the whales seem smart enough to like make out a connection between fishing boats and food.
I do know that people love building robots for the ocean. So I'm definitely going to go. I'm going to go with the second one, I think.
All right, Sam's on robots.
I'm going to go with litter box.
Ooh. The only one I don't like is the dogs one. That sounds so like 1992.
What? When they invented dogs?
You don't need dogs on boats anymore. Yeah. You got robots. I'll go with the litter box one.
Well, everyone, thank you so much. Oh. It's the dog.
No. Dog?
Yeah. So recently, Tucker, which is the name of the star dog, retired after 10 years of sniffing out whale poop.
The dog who loves poop more than any other dog.
Yeah, so Tucker's a black lab mix and has sniffed out the majority of the 348 fecal samples that had been gathered over the course of his career. So very effective at poop sniffing out. I was also surprised. Like, it seems like Tucker could be like, it's that way, but it's like, well, where's the wind coming from? How does Tucker know what actual direction it is?
Yeah.
But hey, dogs, they're very good at that. You can find out things like hormone levels, pollutants like DDT. You can tell what sex the animal was, and it helps researchers figure out the whale's diet, how it changes over the course of a year. It can even assess how high rates of late-term stillbirth are in pregnant killer whales, connected to diet and the presence of toxins. Also, bonus for Tucker is that he didn't like the water, so he never went in and just stayed in the boat and had no interest in going in the water. And yes, they do use pooper scoopers to pick up the very orange poop out of the water. And Tucker could sniff poops out from about a mile away. And this is also a thing that has been used to get poop from owls, caribou, and giant armadillo. You were right that there are lots of robots in ocean science, and there are plenty of robots in whale science, and they're mostly used to follow a pod, but they mostly use sound to track populations because they can't, like, keep up with the whales. Mm. There is also a robot called Luigi that's designed to collect samples from sewers, like for human sewers.
Because he's like a plumber.
Yeah, that's why they call him Luigi.
Do you think anybody will ever listen to our show and then do one of the fake ideas that we come up with? Because a poop scooping robot seems like a great idea.
Yeah, you don't have to use your scooper.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe hard. Yeah. Well, what you'd need is like a drone to like be taking pictures of the pod and then see when the orange shows up.
Right.
And then like deploy the pooper scooper.
I thought for sure the orange was going to factor into the answer because you said it so many times. And a robot could see orange, I imagine.
Yes, I think it could. As for the litter box, this is a kind of a thing in the Gulf of Alaska where fishermen, they created an acoustic lure using speakers that played the sound of fishing boats to lure sperm whales away from their actual boats because they didn't want the sperm whales around because they grab the fish off of their lines and eat all of the things that they catch.
Little sneaky guys.
Next up, we're going to take a short break and then it'll be time for the Fact Off. Welcome back, everybody. Sam Buck totals. I've got three. Stefan's got one. And Sari and Sam don't have anything yet, but they have a chance to get some points right now. Sari and Sam have brought science facts to present to me and Stefan in an attempt to blow our minds. And we each have a Sam Buck to award to the fact that we like the most. And to decide who's going to go first, I've got a trivia question for you. The North Atlantic right whale has been listed as endangered since 1970 and is one of the most endangered species of whale today. At the end of 2018, researchers' best estimate for how many remained was this number.
I'm going to say...
Oh, okay, you go first.
Oh, go ahead.
No, please, after you.
I'm going to say 120.
Okay. Sam?
I'm going to say 45.
Oh. The answer is 409. So better than you guys thought, but still not enough.
It's not great.
That means that, Sarah, you get to decide who goes first.
Sam, you can go first.
Oh, thanks. Okay. In 2019, researchers from Stanford voyaged out into Monterey Bay with a 20-foot pole and some suction cups to try to collect data that had never been collected before, the heart rate of a blue whale. Since it hadn't been recorded before, you might think that getting a blue whale's heartbeat is a pretty tricky proposition, and you are right. Because even though you can row right up to them when they come up for air, because they're just kind of hanging out and breathing, and stick something onto them, most of the skin that's close enough to their heart is super stretchy and expands a lot when they're underwater sucking up all the water to eat the krill, and it would pop the suction cups right off. But there's like one spot just next to the left fin that doesn't stretch too much and is close enough to the heart to get the reading. And so that's where they stuck it on. And after their first attempt, the heart monitoring device that they stuck on stayed on for 8 hours of the whale that they chose diving for food and surfacing, and then detached and floated to the surface to be collected with all the precious new data. And the results that they found kind of flew in the face of what they had people had assumed about blue whale hearts. So mammals that dive to eat switch between a really rapid heart rate when they're surfaced to get their blood reoxygenated and a really slow heart rate when they're diving so that they can stay underwater longer. Like a blue whale stays underwater for 15 minutes at a time. And based on equations that pretty faithfully calculate other mammals' resting and active heart rates, the blue whale should have a resting heart rate of 15 beats per minute and a diving heart rate of 11 beats per minute.
Okay.
But the data they collected showed that the resting heart rate was more than twice that, and it topped out at 37 beats per minute, and that their diving heart rate was way slower than they thought, and it ranged from 8 beats per minute all the way down to 2 beats per minute.
Whoa!
And even though those are both really low numbers by human standards, at its most extreme, that's like a 10 to 1 change in heart rate, and at humans' most extreme, we only have a 3 to 1 change in heart rate. So they're like really pumping it for how big they are. So based on this, the researchers suggested that the blue whale, which is the biggest animal that we've ever found that has ever lived, might have reached the largest size possible for an animal, or at least like a diving aquatic animal, but possibly any kind of animal to get, since their hearts were already beating extremely fast during their normal just like cycle of eating and surfacing, and they weren't doing anything weird like running away from something. And their hearts were already beating like as fast and extremely as possible to give them enough oxygen to dive to eat as much food as they need to live. And that's just what they need to do all day, every day. So it seems like it's possible that they've reached the perfect equilibrium of maximum heart output and maximum food input, and they've started bumping up against like the fundamental laws of physics that's stopping them from getting any bigger.
Do you know how many tries it took to figure out where the least stretchy part of tissue was?
I think from what I read, this was like the first attempt with this type of suction cup. So I think they just knew what they needed to do and they did it the first time. Mm.
Cool.
Well, that's super cool. I'm glad that we've done this good whale research.
Uh-huh.
Sari, what do you got for us?
I have something directly related to the stretchiness of whales, I'm very excited about. It dovetails so nicely. Like in Stefan's poem, he said that baleen whales are the ones that filter feed. They suck in water and then squeeze it back out through keratinous bristle hair things to filter out krill and other snacks. And there's a group of baleen whales called rargles, which include humpback and blue whales, and they filter feed in a very extreme way called lunge feeding. And this is where they swim forward really fast, like up to 4 meters per second, and then open their mouths and balloon out. So they look basically like a giant tadpole with the back end of their body still thin and then the front end of their body completely full, sucking in water that's about 140% of its entire body mass. One estimate is 70,000 liters of water at one time. And then drag, like a parachute, slows them to a stop. So this is a really energetically costly maneuver. And this makes it sound like they might just pop like a balloon with that much water rushing in. But there are three major physiological adaptations that make this possible. One, their jaw joints are flexible links that lets their jaws open up to 90 degrees. And the bones in their chin area of their mandible aren't fused like in many other mammals. And instead, there's a specialized sensory organ in there, in the gap, that help these movements happen safely and coordinated. Number two, their tongue is really weak and mostly elastic fatty tissue. So ours is really muscular. Theirs is really floppy. So it can flop backwards and squish to the bottom of their mouth, which extends all the way to their belly button to make room for water flooding in, which is weird. So their tongue just gets out of the way. And then number three, not only do they have extra stretchy skin, like Sam was saying, and in their blubber and muscle that helps their mouth expand, they also have something basically unheard of in animals, stretchy nerves. So while humans get whiplash or can get really bad nerve damage from stretching too far or too fast, whale nerves are sort of like a bungee cord or a slinky wrapped in like a sock is sort of how I interpret the diagram.
Okay.
But there's like a folded inside part with a solid collagen reinforced elastic outer coating. And as the outside stretches up to twice its original length, the inside just unfolds and uncurls to avoid that intense strain. And then when it stops sucking in water, pushes it back out, the whole thing just collapses again and the outside looks relatively the same, but the inside folds up again.
I don't know how I got this far in life without realizing that a whale's mouth opens like 90 degrees. And the illustration that I have just come across of that is just so deeply different from how I imagine a whale to look. It looks like a microorganism. Its mouth is way too big.
I thought their mouths didn't even open at all. I thought they just kind of went, ink, a little bit. They go full Pac-Man, though.
They go full Pac-Man.
Do they need a tongue, or are they just got a vestigial tongue?
I think they use it, so once they squeeze out the water, I read somewhere in one of these articles that they use their tongue to, like, lick the back of their baleen to, like, scoop it into their stomach,
or
like, help swallow a little bit. So they need a little bit of muscular action, but I don't think it's how, it's like not how they make sounds. So they don't need a tongue in the way that we have a tongue.
So we are choosing between Sari's explanation of all of the different adaptations necessary for whales to extremely quickly inflate basically half of their body with water, or Sam with a discussion of how blue whale heartbeats were measured for the first time and also how strangely variable blue whale heartbeats are.
There's big pumpers and big gulpers.
Which of these people is more of your friend? Which friend do you like more?
Okay, I'm not on that criteria, but I think I'm ready.
I'm not. I was too busy making you uncomfortable. Three, two, one, Sam.
Oh, no. Sorry, Sari.
I knew about this suction cup thing, but I didn't realize how significant the science was that we had figured out from it. I love their big hearts. And let's be honest, we all know who the most lovable tangenter is. It's you.
It's me.
Everyone loves you, Sam. Well,
everybody loves all of us in a different way.
So diplomatic.
All right, now it's time to ask the Science Couch. We've got a listener question for our Couch of Finely Honed Scientific Mind. It's from at Verderwald. How do whales navigate and remember where they've been before? I have no idea.
And that's what scientists say, too.
Oh, hey, all right. Well, this one was easy.
So we have no idea, but we have some guesses. Because scientists aren't just happy stating no idea, period. Mm-hmm. Studying whale migration is really hard because we can't study them in a box. And whales are so big that their migration is also incredibly big. So it's just like you have to track whales over great distances. But one project took 8 years using satellite to track humpback whale migration. They traveled about 10,000 miles. I think that's in one direction. And using satellite tags that were embedded in 16 whales from 2003 to 2010, they noticed that humpback whales never tracked more than 5 degrees off their planned course.
Wow.
And in over half of the segments, or around half of the segments, they stayed within 1 degree of their planned course, which was like beyond what they thought was possible for an animal migration, particularly one in the water. And their guess is that it has to do with a lot of different mechanisms. So using solar bodies like the sun and stars as a frame of reference, some degree of the Earth's magnetism, which also influences a lot of animals that migrate in ways that we don't quite understand, and environmental cues, whether that's other whale songs, like helping steer them in the correct direction, or possibly echoes, or landmarks like underwater volcanoes, so they can like pass by that in a distinct direction. There are some other studies that reinforce these theories where we think solar storms have caused whales, particularly gray whales, to beach themselves more often, where they get messed up because they might use the magnetism from the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, and then the solar storm messes that up, and so then they're thrown off.
I love the idea that whales are just listening to other whales, and there's just, like, one whale knows what they're doing, and everybody else is just following them.
Like, this way. I see the Big Dipper.
Oh, God. Whales are so smart, and I want to know. I want to talk to one.
There's a whale out there who's looking at, like, the moon at the same time we're looking at the moon.
Somewhere out there.
Do all whales echolocate, or is that just a some whale thing?
I think most, if not all, whales vocalize for like communication and navigation, and maybe some sort of feeding. But I think echolocation is a particular kind of, I make a sound and then I listen for that exact sound reflecting back, that I don't think all whales have the equipment for.
They're too big to care if something's in their way, maybe.
Yeah, unlike bats, I don't think they're trying to avoid things that are eating them, or like trees.
Yeah.
It's a aquatic tree, you know?
Yeah, I like the idea that whales don't have to worry about running into stuff. It's just like, you need to worry about me running into you. I don't have to worry about me running into you. That was the weirdest way to say that. If you want to ask the Science Couch your question, follow us on Twitter at @SciShowTangents, where we'll tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week. Thank you to @WarlockTopus, @Lioness82, and everybody else who tweeted us your questions for this episode. Final scores! Sari with 0, Stefan with 1, Sam with 2, and me with 3! Which means
you're still
Sari
last.
And Sam are now tied for the lead, and I'm still pretty deeply in last. If you like this show and you want to help us out, you can do that in a bunch of ways that are pretty easy. You can leave us a review on Stitcher or iTunes. That helps us know what you like about the show. You can also tweet out your favorite moments from the episode so that we can look at your tweets and go, ah, that was nice. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just tell people about us. Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
I've been Stefan Chin.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is a co-production of Complexly and the wonderful team at WNYC Studios. It's created by all of us and produced by Caitlin Hoffmeister and Sam Schultz, who also edits a lot of these episodes along with Hiroko Matsushima. Our editorial assistant is Tabuki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Bedish, and we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you, and remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted.
But one more thing. Pygmy sperm whales in the genus Kogia are relatively small when we think of whales. They're only like 3.3 meters long. And they have a unique defense mechanism that is sometimes described by scientists as, quote, anal syrup. What this means is they have a sac near their intestines that releases a bunch of reddish brown goop that looks like poop or blood or something. And it can cover an area of 100 square meters. I don't know why it isn't cubed. While the whale escapes from whatever scared it. And unlike bright orange poop, we haven't actually collected or analyzed anal syrup goop. So what it's made of is just totally speculation.
How could you resist collecting anal syrup?